Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
And today we are really digging into a situation that's, well, it's complex, it's contradictory, and frankly, it seems to be fundamentally reshaping American governance as we speak.
Yeah, that's right. So we're here today for the definitive account, the federal news update for Monday, October 27th, 2025.
Our mission really is to give you a granular and exhaustive review of every significant U.S. federal government action, every bit of activity that's happened since the beginning of October 25th, 2025.
And when you lay out all the source material, Alex, a really strange pattern starts to emerge, doesn't it?
It really does, because the immediate headline, the thing you see everywhere, it isn't just simple Washington gridlock. It's actually, well, it's a paradox.
Exactly. The core conflict that just jumps out from the sources is this. The U.S. government is, on one hand, completely paralyzed by one of the longest shutdowns in its history.
Right. Seems like nothing's getting done.
But, and this is the key part, the executive branch is simultaneously hyperactive. It's pushing forward a really fundamental strategic policy agenda at, frankly, breakneck speed.
So that visible dysfunction, you know, the shutdown itself, the stories about unpaid workers, the closed services, that's almost like camouflage.
It is. It's masking these deliberate strategic actions that are happening incredibly quickly and with a very clear purpose. The analysis suggests that what looks like a total government collapse is actually being leveraged, used for what the sources are basically calling disruptive governance.
Okay, so the key takeaway for you listening right now has to be this. This shutdown isn't just about Congress failing to agree on budget numbers. That's part of it, sure.
But it's more than that.
It's being actively wielded, used as a tool and instrument to achieve political goals that were already there. And often it's happening faster precisely because Congress isn't watching. There's no oversight.
Exactly. And before we dive into those disruptive actions, we really have to set the stage. We need to establish the context of this massive inaction first.
Right. The legislative vacuum. That's what makes all this executive activity even possible.
Yeah. So the context, of course, is this protracted government shutdown. It started way back on October 1st, 2025.
And we're now late in the month. This isn't just a temporary funding lapse anymore. It's really snowballed, hasn't it? It's become a full-blown, cascading national crisis.
It has. And largely because the legislative branch seems to have just given up trying to fix it.
The level of inaction in Congress just since October 25th is pretty startling when you look at it.
It is. The House of Representatives, they've been in recess since the shutdown began. Mm. And as of right now, late October, there is zero floor activity scheduled until October 28th.
And even that date, October 28th, feels a bit misleading, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, because leadership immediately designated the period from October 27th through November 2nd as a district work period.
Which, practically speaking, signals what exactly?
It signals a complete halt, a total stop in any real effort by the House to resolve the funding crisis. When leadership tells members to go back to their districts during a crisis this big, they're basically saying, look, a deal isn't close. It signals they're using the crisis for political positioning back home, not for solving the problem here in Washington.
And the Senate isn't much different, is it?
No, they're playing a similar game. Okay, technically, they do have a procedural vote scheduled for October 27th. It's for the judicial nomination of Daniel J. Tableson to the Seventh Circuit.
Right, the judge.
But besides that one vote, their schedule is completely empty when it comes to any action on a continuing resolution, you know, the thing needed to actually fund the government.
Let's pause on that Tableson nomination for a second. Why focus on confirming a federal judge, a lifetime appointment, while, as we'll discuss, millions are facing potential starvation? What does that tell us?
Well, it really highlights the administration's priorities, doesn't it? Judicial nominations, especially these lifetime seats on appellate courts, represent a lasting policy legacy. It goes way beyond temporary budget fights.
And the judiciary is still funded, unlike other departments.
Exactly. The judicial branch is insulated from the shutdown chaos. So the executive and their allies in the Senate can push these appointments through without needing to tackle the really difficult, messy funding questions right now.
And if we look back just a few days to October 23rd, there was that failed Senate vote. They couldn't even agree on a bill just to pay essential federal workers and the military troops.
Right. And that failure just underscores this massive ideological chasm. They're so dug in, they can't even find common ground on paying the people legally required to keep basic security functions running.
Which brings us directly to the human cost. The federal workforce, the degradation of public services, it's immediate.
Hundreds of thousands of essential personnel. Think TSA officers at the airport, air traffic controllers, border patrol agents, they're legally required to work, but they're doing it without pay.
And the source material uses words like shock, immense anxiety. This isn't just some abstract political issue, it's manufactured financial hardship for real people.
Absolutely. People with mortgages, car payments, student loans, their financial stability is basically being held hostage as political leverage.
Okay, let's give the listener that granular operational status report you mentioned, like concrete examples of services breaking down, because this affects everyone, doesn't matter where you live.
Right. Let's break it down. The Small Business Administration, the SBA, usually a vital engine for growth.
Yeah.
It has completely stopped processing all new business loans. That includes the main programs, the 7A and 504 loans.
So if you're a small business owner trying to start up or expand,
you're stuck. That capital pipeline is just shut off. That immediately puts a drag on economic activity everywhere.
And for travelers.
Immediate headaches, passport services, significant delays. If you need a new passport or a renewal, expect a long wait.
What about global entry?
Processing for global entry applications, you know, for trusted travelers, completely suspended.
Okay. And veterans.
This is crucial. While the VA medical centers themselves, the hospitals and clinics, remain open for patient care.
Thank goodness for that.
Yes. But the crucial support systems around them, things like public contact services, those specialized call centers veterans rely on, benefits counseling, those are either closed entirely or running with skeletal crews who aren't getting paid.
Wow. And the shutdown's reach, it's even hitting really sensitive national security sectors, right?
Yeah, the report we reviewed noted something quite alarming back on October 17th. A key U.S. nuclear agency announced it was sending 80% of its workforce home.
80% at a nuclear agency. Sam, losing that much staff, even temporarily, that raises some very serious, very real national security questions, doesn't it? About monitoring, maintenance, facility security during a crisis.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not theoretical. So the takeaway from this whole context section, this legislative paralysis, it's not just a side effect of the shutdown.
No.
It's the condition being actively created, or at least allowed, by the legislative branch's inaction. And this failure, this vacuum, it sets the stage perfectly for the executive branch to make moves that have even deeper, maybe more devastating consequences.
Which brings us to something we absolutely cannot gloss over, the looming social crisis. This is where the administrative mess of the shutdown turns into a potential humanitarian catastrophe. We have to talk about the SNAP cliff.
This really is the most acute, the most immediate threat facing the country right now because of this shutdown. SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly food stamps.
Yeah.
The plan is for benefits to stop completely.
In November. And this isn't speculation, is it? The USDA, the Department of Agriculture, they've been crystal clear.
Unequivocal.
Yeah.
They've stated point blank. Because the appropriations have lapsed, there is no money legally available to issue those November benefits. Period.
Wait, Sam, the sheer scale here, it just demands we pause and take it in. Nearly 42 million people.
42 million.
That's more than 12% of the entire U.S. population who are about to face immediate severe food insecurity.
And public health experts, they are not holding back. They're using language like this could trigger the greatest hunger catastrophe since the Great Depression.
Wow.
This isn't some far-off possibility. This is set to hit communities everywhere, urban, rural, across the country within weeks.
And what makes this so politically charged and so central to this idea of disruptive governance is the administration's stance on it. They're not just passively letting it happen.
No, they've actively confirmed that the USDA will not use emergency reserves or contingency funds. There are sometimes, you know, limited pots of money or legal workarounds. The USDA might have to bridge short funding gaps.
Right. Administrative flexibility.
Exactly. And the deliberate decision not to use any of that available leeway. Critics see that as a clear strategy. It maximizes the pain of the shutdown.
So they're essentially guaranteeing the social safety net collapses to pressure Congress.
That's the argument, that they're using the most vulnerable people as political pawns in this high-stakes negotiation.
And it's not just SNAP, is it? WIC is also affected.
Yes, WIC, the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. Crucial support for pregnant women, new mothers, young kids.
Often the most vulnerable.
Absolutely. That program is also expected to run out of its funding very quickly. And the fallout from that isn't just hunger today. It's long-term public health impacts, child development issues.
The federal failure here is so stark that we're actually seeing states trying to step into the breach, which ironically, just highlights how bad the federal problem is.
Right. Look at California. On October 22nd, recognizing just how huge this crisis was about to become, they announced an emergency response plan.
What are they doing?
Setting aside a pretty substantial $80 million in state funds and taking the pretty dramatic step of deploying the National Guard.
The National Guard? For what?
To support food banks. Because those food banks are already bracing for a level of demand they know they simply cannot meet on their own.
And $80 million, I mean, that's a lot for a state, but compared to the federal SNNT program.
It's a drop in the bucket. That's the key analytical point here. $80 million state dollars, while commendable, necessary even, cannot possibly replace the hundreds of billions in federal money that fuels SNNP nationally.
So these state efforts, they really just serve as this stark mirror, reflecting the profound failure at the federal level.
And illustrating the devastating, incredibly fast, real-world consequences of this political stalemate, the executive branch has effectively allowed, if not engineered, a massive domestic crisis.
Which creates the perfect distraction, doesn't it? While the nation is rightly focused on this immediate, terrifying threat of 42 million people potentially going hungry,
the executive branch is busy elsewhere, advancing its own agenda with, frankly, startling efficiency.
Okay, let's pivot then. Section 3 in our outline. The executive branch amidst crisis. Specifically, how they're finding these unconventional ways to get funding and pushing forward a global strategy, all while the domestic situation deteriorates.
Right. This is where we really see the administration pushing the boundaries, systematically challenging the traditional constitutional structure of the U.S. government.
Well, so?
Well, since October 25th, the White House has been actively, openly bypassing Congress's traditional power of the purse.
Let's get specific. That action revealed on October 25th regarding military pay, that seemed extraordinary.
It was. The revelation was that Timothy Mellon, who's known to be a prominent supporter of the administration, donated a huge sum, $130 million, specifically to facilitate the payment of U.S. military service members during the shutdown.
A private donation paying the troops.
Yes. And this is highly, highly problematic from a constitutional standpoint. We've seen administrations shift funds around internally before, you know, reallocating money within DHS or DOD using transfer authorities.
Right. Bureaucratic maneuvering.
But using a massive private donation from a political supporter to fund a core function like paying the armed forces, that crosses a fundamental line.
Okay, explain that for the listener. Why is that so constitutionally fraught? What exactly is the power of the purse that this challenges?
The power of the purse is right there in Article 1 of the Constitution. It gives Congress, and only Congress, the exclusive authority to raise taxes and decide how public money is spent to appropriate funds.
It's Congress's main check on the president.
It's the single most powerful check the legislative branch has on the executive branch. So when a private citizen or a corporation or any group can just step in and fund a core government function, especially the military, it completely usurps that power. It cuts Congress out of the loop.
And the implications. The analysis suggests this is more than just unusual.
Oh, yeah. Legal experts aren't just raising eyebrows. They're calling it a dangerous precedent. Because think about it. If an executive can start relying on private, politically aligned donors to fund the parts of government they like,
say ICE or specific military units or certain intelligence programs.
Exactly. If they can do that indefinitely, then Congress's control over those operations basically vanishes. It fundamentally shifts financial power away from the elected legislature and concentrates it in the executive branch and its network of private, unaccountable funders.
It's a shadow budget, almost.
In effect, yeah. Now, at the same time this is happening, let's look over at the Treasury Department. They're managing the immediate cash crunch from the shutdown, but they're also overseeing this other major, really sobering fiscal milestone.
Which is?
During this shutdown period, the U.S. gross national debt crossed $38 trillion for the very first time.
$38 trillion. Just pause on that number.
It's huge. And what's maybe even more alarming is how fast we got here. The report notes that the latest $1 trillion in debt was added faster than any period except for the absolute peak crisis spending during the COVID-19 pandemic.
So this isn't just a slow, steady climb anymore.
No, the pace of accumulation has accelerated significantly again. And this isn't some abstract economic issue just for Wall Street. This rapid debt growth affects everyone listening.
How so?
Well, economists warn it directly fuels inflation, makes your groceries, your gas, everything cost more. And critically, It puts pressure on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates higher to try and control that inflation.
Which means?
Higher borrowing costs for everybody. Hmm. Mortgages cost more. Car loans cost more. Credit card interest rates go up. It threatens long-term economic stability for households right across the board.
Okay, so you've got this constitutional drama over funding, this massive debt milestone, and yet, despite all that chaos, the core policy engine of the administration is just humming along.
Completely uninterrupted. It's remarkable. Treasury sub-agencies like the IRS and OFAC are moving full steam ahead, especially implementing new regulations.
Tell us about the IRS. What are they focusing on?
They've been very actively issuing new guidance, new FAQs, all related to the administration's big signature tax law, the One Big Beautiful Bill.
Right.
And just in the period leading up to and including October 25th, they released significant new rules and clarifications on several really controversial parts of that law.
Can you break down what those technical IRS things mean in practice? Form 1099-K?
Sure. The Form 1099-K guidance deals with reporting thresholds for third-party payment processors. Think PayPal, Venmo, eBay. The new rules dramatically lower the amount, meaning many more small businesses, gig workers, people selling things online suddenly have new, complex reporting requirements.
So more paperwork, more potential tax liability for small players?
Exactly. And the IRS is pushing ahead with implementing this complex change right now, shutdown or no shutdown. They also put out detailed FAQs on the employee retention credits, the ERC program.
That's been controversial too.
Very. And new rules related to reporting car loan interest. The point is, this isn't just routine bureaucratic tidying up. This is the detailed, often contentious work of implementing a major complex piece of legislation. The administrative state is functioning perfectly fine when it comes to pushing the administration's policy goals forward.
Even as other parts of the government are starving for funds.
Precisely. And this hyperfunctionality extends globally, too. We saw Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, remain fully operational. On October 24th, they issued a whole new round of counter-narcotics sanctions designations, targeting networks down in Central America.
So the part of the government that deals with foreign financial power is working fine.
Totally fine. It highlights this stark dichotomy. One part of the government is overseeing the collapse of the domestic social safety net, while another part is diligently executing complex global financial and foreign policy without missing a beat.
The domestic paralysis seems completely irrelevant to the president's diplomatic agenda. We saw a major diplomatic blitz in Southeast Asia recently.
Absolutely. The president held multiple press gaggles, informal briefings, aboard Air Force One on October 24th and 25th. This all culminated in a flurry of major agreements announced from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia on October 26th.
And this is foreign policy being done at high speed, completely outside the usual congressional review or approval processes for trade deals.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's quickly list these because they clearly form a strategic pattern. There was an agreement announced with Vietnam, a framework for a reciprocal trade agreement.
Okay.
With Malaysia, they announced not just a full reciprocal trade agreement, but also a really important memorandum of understanding, an MOU, on critical minerals supply chains.
Critical minerals. That sounds key.
It is. Then with Cambodia, another reciprocal trade agreement. And with Thailand, similar to Vietnam, a framework for a trade agreement, plus another one of those critical minerals, MOUs.
These aren't just symbolic handshakes, are they? Reciprocal trade agreements, MOUs on supply chains. That sounds like deep, long-term stuff.
It is. These trade agreements aim to lower barriers, standardize regulations over time, and those critical minerals MOUs are particularly pointed.
Why critical minerals specifically?
Because these are the minerals essential for modern technology. Think batteries, semiconductors, defense applications.
Mm-hmm.
And who dominates the current global supply chain for many of these?
China.
So this entire diplomatic blitz, it represents a very clear, very concerted effort to counter China's influence, particularly its Belt and Road Initiative in the region.
So the administration is building a U.S.-led alternative, a trade and supply chain structure in the Indo-Pacific.
That's exactly what it looks like, securing vital economic and strategic interests, especially for these future-facing technologies, entirely insulated from the legislative mess back home.
The sheer speed and the scope of these executive actions,
you know,
bypassing Congress's funding power with private money, executing this massive foreign policy shift, it just highlights that asymmetry of power the shutdown creates.
It's not just gridlock allowing things not to happen. It's gridlock enabling the executive to do things unilaterally.
Right. It's an active power grab masked as dysfunction. Okay, let's move into section four of our outline. This covers domestic policy shifts, particularly controversies brewing at the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense. These seem to directly challenge institutional norms.
Yeah, this is where we see the executive branch using its existing powers, its enforcement and communication arms, for what appear to be highly charged political ends. Let's start with the DOJ, the Department of Justice, and that really controversial decision about election monitoring.
Okay, what happened there?
On October 24th, the DOJ publicly announced a plan. They intend to dispatch federal election monitors to specific polling sites for the upcoming November 4th election.
Where are they sending them?
To Passaic County in New Jersey, and then five specific counties in California: Los Angeles, Orange, Kern, Riverside, and Fresno.
And what's the justification given for sending federal monitors to these specific places?
Officially, the basis came from formal requests submitted by the state Republican parties in those states. These requests apparently cited only vague reports of irregularities and talked about needing to ensure election integrity.
Vague reports.
Yes. The Attorney General, in announcing it, framed the move as just a neutral necessity, you know, making sure everyone complies with federal voting laws, including the Voting Rights Act.
But the selection of counties, L.A., Orange County, Fresno in California, Passaic in New Jersey, these are largely Democratic areas, aren't they?
Predominantly large, diverse, and Democratic-leaning areas. And Democratic officials there reacted immediately and very fiercely.
What did they say?
The California governor's office put out a statement calling the deployment a blatant intimidation tactic meant explicitly to suppress the vote. New Jersey's attorney general called it highly inappropriate political interference in state-run elections.
And this deployment aligns pretty neatly with the president's ongoing rhetoric about voter fraud, doesn't it? Even though those claims remain largely unsubstantiated.
It aligns perfectly. And the danger here, according to critics and election law experts, is the depoliticization of election law enforcement.
Mm.
When you send federal monitors, especially based on partisan requests citing vague concerns, into specific communities, it can create longer lines, it can make voters feel intimidated or watched, and it risks turning what should be a routine civic process into a potential point of conflict or confusion. It chills participation.
Yet, while this highly political move is happening, the DOJ is also just carrying on with its normal business.
Absolutely. It's that paradox again. On the very same day, October 24th, the DOJ also announced the successful conviction of two individuals for providing material support to ISIS. Routine, important counterterrorism work happening alongside this politically explosive election intervention.
They maintain the appearance of normal legal function while simultaneously using the agency's unique power to wade right into the most politically charged arenas.
Precisely. And we see a similar, though maybe even more structurally drastic, kind of institutional upheaval happening over at the Department of Defense, specifically regarding press access and accountability.
What's going on at the Pentagon?
This is really a fundamental shift.
Yeah.
The traditional Pentagon press corps, we're talking about the established journalists from major mainstream news organizations like the Associated Press, the New York Times, CNN, Reuters, even historically conservative outlets like Fox News.
The regulars.
The regulars. They collectively turned in their press credentials and walked out in protest.
A mass walkout. Why? What triggered that?
It was prompted by the new defense secretary, Pete Hegseth. He imposed very restrictive new reporting policies. Essentially, these new rules eliminated the ability for journalists to have independent, unscheduled access to DOD officials.
So no more buttonholing generals in the hallway.
Pretty much. The new policy demanded that all communications, all interview requests, had to be routed through and vetted by political staff within the secretary's office. The press corps saw this as a complete chokehold on transparency, an unacceptable barrier to independent reporting.
Okay, so the established press walks out. What was the DOD's response? Did they negotiate?
No, they didn't back down an inch. Instead, they immediately announced they were installing what they literally termed the next generation of the Pentagon press corps.
The next generation. Who does that consist of?
This replacement group is made up of more than 60 journalists, but they weren't drawn from the usual pool. They came from a specifically curated list provided by the administration.
A curated list? Of what kind of outlets?
Overwhelmingly conservative, pro-administration, and in some cases far-right outlets. The source material confirms representation from places like The Hateway Pundit, Mike Lindell's Lindell TV, Human Events, Breitbart, Tim Pool's Timcast.
Wow. Outlets often known for echoing administration talking points or even promoting conspiracy theories.
Exactly. Many have a documented history of doing just that, and the implication here is enormous. We really need to break down why this matters so much for the listener. This isn't just some inside-the-beltway media spat.
Right. What's the real significance?
This looks like a strategic, deliberate move to fundamentally control the narrative coming out of the Pentagon. Control the story about military operations, about the massive defense budget, about defense policy decisions.
How does replacing the press corps achieve that?
By replacing independent journalists, whose job includes skepticism and holding power accountable, with reporters from outlets known to be favorable, even sycophantic, towards the administration's agenda. You're essentially creating what amounts to a state-aligned media apparatus within the Pentagon.
Which means
it severely curtails genuine transparency. It limits public accountability for the country's largest federal agency and its actions around the globe. It risks degrading the quality and reliability of information that the American public receives about its own military.
It effectively shields defense operations and decision-making from independent scrutiny, creates a closed information loop where the DoD can push its preferred narrative without challenge.
It's a textbook example of that disruptive governance in action. Using a crisis or a manufactured conflict here, the clash over access rules to implement a fundamental change in how the institution operates and communicates.
Okay, let's shift gears again. Section 5 in the outline points to another major front, the deregulatory blitz. This seems to be about using the administrative state itself to dismantle protections, often under the cover of the shutdown chaos.
Exactly. This is the third key part of the executive strategy we're seeing. Systematically weakening or dismantling the administrative state's regulatory and protective functions, but doing it from within those agencies, using their own processes.
And the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, seems to be a prime example here.
Absolutely. The EPA announced a proposed new rule. It was announced back on October 21st. But the details are emerging now, and it seems designed to systematically weaken, even dismantle, environmental protections for some really dangerous toxic chemicals.
Like what kind of chemicals?
We're talking about PFAS, those persistent forever chemicals you hear about in water supplies, but also things like formaldehyde, a known carcinogen, and even asbestos. Substances with long histories of known health risks.
And how is this new rule proposing to weaken protections?
It's a multi-pronged attack, really, on decades of established science and regulation. First, the proposed rule would drastically shorten the time allowed for reviewing the safety of chemicals, moving complex assessments from years down to just months.
Which your critics would say isn't enough time for thorough science.
Exactly. Second, it aims to fundamentally alter the scientific methodology the EPA uses to assess risk, often in ways that appear to favor industry-provided data or interpretations over independent research.
And there was something specific about states' rights in there, too.
Yes, this really jumped out in the source material. The proposed rule includes language that explicitly prohibits states, think places like California or New York, that often have tougher environmental laws from enacting their own more stringent protections against these specific toxins.
So the federal government is setting a lower bar and telling states they're not allowed to go higher.
Precisely. It's using federal preemption aggressively to lock in a weaker national standard. Former EPA scientists quoted in reports are calling this, quite bluntly, a gift to industry.
And there's another loophole related to worker safety.
Yeah, this one's quite subtle but significant.
Yeah.
The new rule introduces what critics call a giant loophole for worker safety. Basically, it assumes that workers in industrial settings will always properly and consistently use personal protective equipment, like specialized respirators.
It assumes perfect compliance.
Yes. And by making that assumption, the EPA essentially negates its own responsibility to enforce strict environmental thresholds for chemical exposure in the workplace itself. It shifts the burden entirely onto worker behavior rather than limiting the hazard at the source.
But the mechanism that sounds most maybe insidious is this new requirement for gold standard science. That sounds positive on the surface, but what does it actually do?
It sounds great, right? Who could be against gold standard science? But the way this framework is constructed, according to the analysis, makes it almost impossible to actually regulate anything.
Oh.
It mandates that all underlying data used in any EPA risk assessment must meet an incredibly high, almost unattainable procedural standard for public transparency. For example, it requires that all the raw data be made completely public.
Okay, transparency sounds good.
But think about the kind of data needed for health studies. It often includes confidential business information from companies about their chemical processes. Or even more critically, it includes private medical information from individuals who participated in health studies, which is protected by privacy laws like AIPA.
So if a study looks at the health effects of a chemical on a group of people, the researchers can't just release all the individual anonymized medical records because of privacy rules.
Exactly right. They can release aggregated findings, conclusions, methodologies, but not the raw individual level data in many cases. So the critics argue this gold standard is deliberately reverse engineered to be impossible to meet.
Because the necessary studies legally can't meet the standard.
Correct. And if a risk assessment can't meet this procedural hurdle, even if the science itself is sound, the framework allows the EPA to invalidate the assessment, which means no regulation can be based on it.
So the EPA is using its own rulemaking process to effectively neutralize its own ability to regulate toxic chemicals based on health science.
That's the accusation. It's using bureaucracy to shut down its core mission of protecting public health and the environment.
And we're seeing a similar kind of ideological push at other agencies, too, like Health and Human Services.
Yes, HHS. Under Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the department seems strongly aligned with certain national advocacy groups. These are groups that have already been very successful at the state level, pushing for hundreds of bills that target long-established public health policies.
What kind of established policies are being targeted?
Things that have been pillars of public health for decades, like mandatory vaccine requirements for children attending public school, community water fluoridation, which has proven to improve dental health, even basic milk pasteurization standards.
Wow. So efforts to roll back things widely accepted by mainstream science.
Yes. And the concern is that this agenda, which often relies on skepticism towards established scientific consensus, is now being integrated into the policy direction of a key federal health agency, HHS.
And finally, in this deregulatory blitz section, the Department of Education. The administration has long talked about abolishing it, but now they're actually taking steps.
They are actively moving on that long-stated goal, and they seem to be using the shutdown as a catalyst, or at least as cover.
How are they doing it? Not just shutting it down overnight, presumably.
No, it's being done through bureaucratic maneuvers. The key one highlighted is a plan officials are actively exploring right now to transfer the massive federal program that supports Students with Disabilities IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act.
That's a huge program, about $15 billion.
Exactly. The plan is to transfer responsibility for IDEA away from the Department of Education and over to HHS. The Department of Health and Human Services.
Moving a major education program to a health agency.
Yes. And HHS has basically no institutional expertise in managing large-scale K-12 education programs, especially for students with complex disabilities. Critics see this transfer as a deliberate step designed to splinter the Department of Education's functions, making it easier to argue for its eventual elimination.
And the shutdown helps how?
The shutdown provides the perfect justification for the personnel cuts needed to facilitate this kind of reorganization and downsizing. They've already announced layoffs for 465 employees at the Department of Education.
And a significant chunk of those are from the Special Education Office.
Yes. 121 of those layoffs are specifically from the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services, the very office that oversees IDEA. So the administration can cite the funding lapse, the shutdown, as the reason for the layoffs.
While simultaneously achieving their long-term political goal of dismantling the agency piece by piece.
It fits the pattern perfectly. These actions across EPA, HHS, and education aren't just random cuts or policy tweaks. They show a coherent multi-agency strategy using the shutdown as both justification and smokescreen to deconstruct federal regulatory and social welfare functions from the inside out.
Okay, so after this absolutely exhaustive list of executive actions, bypassing funding, global deals, DOJ interventions, Pentagon press corps changes, the regulatory rollbacks, it leaves us with Section 6 in our outline. This focuses on the one major branch of government that actually seems to be functioning with some degree of normalcy, the federal judiciary.
That's right. The federal judiciary really stands in stark contrast to everything else we've discussed. The paralyzed Congress, the hyperactive, boundary-pushing executive.
The courts are still open.
Largely, yes. The judicial branch continues to function pretty much unabated. And critically, unlike most executive agencies, it's mostly insulated from the direct impact of the appropriations battle.
Why is that? Why is the judiciary immune to the shutdown when the SBA, USDA, EPA are facing collapse or major disruption?
It really goes back to its constitutional design, its independence, and crucially, its funding structure. While Congress and the executive agencies rely heavily on those annual appropriations bills that need a continuing resolution to avoid a shutdown, the judiciary has separate, more structural funding mechanisms. Things like permanent appropriations for judges' salaries, fee collections, multi-year funding streams that largely keep the federal courts operational, even when Congress deadlocks on the annual budget. That stability is proving absolutely crucial right now.
And the Supreme Court itself is still hearing cases?
Absolutely. The Supreme Court is right in the middle of its October 2025 term. They are actively hearing oral arguments, deliberating on major constitutional and statutory questions. No slowdown there.
Can you give us a sense of the kinds of major cases they're tackling right now, even amidst all this chaos?
Sure. The source material mentions they're hearing arguments on really significant issues, things like double jeopardy, the complex question of when someone can be tried for the same crime by both state and federal authorities.
Yeah, okay, fundamental rights issues.
Yes. Also, critical cases interpreting the Voting Rights Act are on the docket, and cases questioning the scope of power for federal regulatory agencies like the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, specifically addressing separation of powers arguments.
So these aren't minor technical disputes. These are high-stakes decisions that will shape civil rights, criminal justice, the power of the regulatory state for potentially decades to come.
Exactly. The court is proceeding with its core constitutional functions.
And it's not just the Supreme Court. Lower federal courts are working, too.
Just as active. The report mentions the lower federal courts, district courts, appellate courts, remain fully operational. They're continuing to issue opinions in really complex areas, like patent disputes involving billions of dollars, and also ruling in high-profile cases challenging the actions of federal regulatory agencies.
Like the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That one's often seen as particularly important for reviewing agency actions.
Yes, the D.C. Circuit is mentioned specifically as remaining active, issuing rulings that directly impact how those federal agencies operate.
So what's the real significance of the judiciary remaining stable and functional when other branches are either paralyzed or acting unilaterally?
The significance really cannot be overstated right now. In this environment, the judiciary stands as the sole institutionally stable check. It's slow moving. Yes, that's the nature of judicial review.
Take the time for cases to get there.
Takes a lot of time. But it remains the only real arbiter where the legality, the constitutionality of some of these aggressive executive actions we've discussed.
Yeah.
The unconventional private funding, the sweeping deregulatory moves, the election monitoring might eventually be challenged and adjudicated.
So they represent the last potential backstop, the only pocket of institutional stability capable of reviewing these actions.
In many ways, yes. They provide that crucial, albeit delayed, institutional counterweight in a system currently experiencing widespread governmental dysfunction elsewhere.
Okay, Sam. So let's try to bring all these incredibly detailed threads together now for the synthesis. We've covered legislative paralysis, the SNAP crisis, the executive funding maneuvers, the debt, the foreign policy blitz, the DOJ and DOD controversies, the deregulation, and the functioning judiciary. After reviewing this absolute avalanche of activity just since October 25th, what is the ultimate so what? What's the bottom line for the listener?
I think the so what, the bottom line is that this government shutdown is proving to be far more than just a budgetary dispute or temporary paralysis. It's acting as an active instrument of profound change.
How so?
It's creating this deep and frankly dangerous asymmetry of power. You have the legislative branch almost entirely sidelined, having abdicated its core functions of funding and oversight.
After absent.
And into that vacuum steps the executive branch, operating with unprecedented vigor, speed, and clear purpose. It's using the cover of the shutdown chaos to enact permanent structural changes across government and policy.
And we can probably summarize the core strategy we've seen emerge across all these different examples. The source material seems to point towards a kind of three-front strategy being executed by the executive right now.
I think that's a good way to put it. First, there's the clear effort of bypassing constitutional checks and balances.
Like the military funding.
Exactly. Using that $130 million in private funds to pay the military is the most glaring example of directly challenging Congress's exclusive power of the purse. Combine that with conducting major foreign policy through bilateral agreements that bypass traditional Senate treaty review or congressional trade authority, it systematically marginalizes the legislature's role.
Okay, that's front one. What's the second?
Second, creating parallel structures of accountability or maybe unaccountability.
The Pentagon press corps situation.
That's the prime example. Expelling the traditional independent press corps and replacing them with a curated, politically compliant media apparatus isn't just about press relations. It's a deliberate move to dismantle independent scrutiny, control the public narrative, and effectively shield a powerful part of the executive branch from genuine critical review.
Okay. And the third front?
Third, wielding the administrative state against itself. Using the government's own agencies and processes to achieve goals that undermine those agencies' traditional missions or the broader regulatory framework.
So the examples there would be?
The DOJ intervening in state election processes based on partisan requests. The EPA using that gold standard science framework to functionally tie its own hands, preventing regulation of toxic chemicals. And the Department of Education being actively dismantled through bureaucratic reorganization, using the shutdown's funding lapse as a justification.
So the immediate tangible cost we see is that impending SNEP catastrophe threatening hunger for 42 million people. That's horrific in itself.
Absolutely. That's the acute human tragedy unfolding.
But the longer term cost, based on this analysis, seems even more profound. It's about permanently altering the balance of power between the branches.
Yes, and potentially eroding public trust
right.
in the very institutions that are supposed to provide unbiased information, impartial justice, and basic safety net protections.
So the crisis, therefore, it's not just about a failure to pass a budget. It's fundamentally about testing the absolute limits of presidential authority when Congress is absent or unwilling to act as a check.
It really is. And that tension we're observing right now between the stable but slow judiciary and this incredibly fast-moving, assertive executive branch that seems to be the critical dynamic that will define the future of American governance in the coming weeks and months.
Which leaves us with a final, maybe provocative thought for you, the listener. Given that the judiciary appears to be the only remaining functional independent check on these executive actions, the question really becomes, how long can the institutional resilience and the inherently slow pace of the judicial process actually withstand the sheer speed and singular purpose of a hyperactive executive branch operating essentially without legislative opposition? That inherent tension, that race against time almost, seems like it will define this entire period.
It's a truly challenging moment, demanding exactly this kind of granular attention to what's actually happening day by day. Thank you for diving deep with me into the activity just from October 25th through the 27th, 2025.
And thank you for joining us for the Depth Dive. We'll talk to you next time.